Now we're getting the details of the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents meeting yesterday. Among the decisions, the regents decided to give five of the longest-serving chancellors at the UW system raises, ranging from 4 to 6%.
Karen Herzog joins us now for the details of that and other highlights from the regents meeting yesterday. She's a higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, there was a lot on the table yesterday, and of course, budget season is coming up. Let's start with the raises given to chancellors. You wrote about this. What were the details?
Well, the regents every few years consider raises for chancellors after they do their performance reviews. The last time chancellors received raises was in 2013, and at that time, 10 of the 14 chancellors within UW system received raises. Yesterday, the regents approved raises for five of those 10 chancellors, so they've gotten two raises in the last 3 years. Those raises were between 4 and 6%, and the campuses whose chancellors got the raises were La Crosse, River Falls, Superior, Parkside, and UW-Platteville. And between the two raises through 2013 and the current one, these chancellors saw their pay go up between 18,000 and 23,000 in 3 years.
Now, are raises like this seen as controversial in any way, especially, again, as budget time comes up?
Well, 3 years ago, they certainly were. And at that time, there was a big controversy over the campuses across the state accumulating cash balances that legislators didn't know about. These cash balances totaled about several hundred thousand dollars. They've since changed those practices, and lawmakers remain sensitive to how the money is spent in the UW system. I haven't heard any reaction today from lawmakers unhappy about these newest raises, but there is a lot of sensitivity to pay because many in the UW system have not received raises in recent years.
Now, before we get into some more details from the meeting yesterday, let's look at that bigger picture a little more on the budget. The university is putting together or has laid out a budget plan. Governor Walker has made sympathetic noises to maybe some increases under certain conditions. Is there a sense that maybe some funding might be added or I guess in some cases restored to the UW system?
Well, I think a lot of factors will go into that, and it depends on how other state agencies are doing with their budgets and what their needs are. I know transportation and K-12 are going to be big priorities in the funding for this upcoming budget. President Cross, rather, has requested some additional funding to the tune of about $42 million beyond what the university system has received in this past biennium. And those are tied to very specific initiatives that he says will better prepare students for jobs in the workforce and help the university system do its best to move students through quickly and efficiently and make an education more affordable.
Talking to Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the state's higher education budget and UW system regents meeting yesterday. Another proposal that came out of that meeting yesterday, Karen, a proposed 2% raise for UW system employees for transparency's sake. WPR, Wisconsin Public Radio, many of us here are employees of the UW system. Not all, but this is a story that could affect us, so a disclosure there. But what's going on with this proposed raise?
Well, the regents approved a request that Ray Cross, the system president, made. He would like to add money to the base pay pool. That's all the money available for salaries within the UW system, so that there would be enough money available for raises over the next 2 years. Now, the increase he's seeking is 2% each of the next 2 years. That would be a total of $78 million over those 2 years. Not everyone would get the raise. This is the money that would be distributed among campuses, and chancellors would decide. It could be awarded on the basis of merit. Some chancellors could decide to award across the board to everybody on their campus. Another issue is retention, when they need to make counteroffers to faculty who get job offers elsewhere. UW-Madison has been very effective in keeping faculty with counteroffers. Other campuses don't have the resources for that necessarily at this time.
And that reminds me, before this meeting, you had written that one thing that might be on the agenda was an idea of increasing the power of chancellors on their campuses. Some faculty departments were not happy about that. What was that idea, and what ended up happening yesterday?
Well, that is a controversy that has been brewing for 2 years, and it all started, as you may recall, 2 years ago in 2015, when the legislature was considering the biennial budget that we're currently finishing the fiscal year in next June, I guess, is the end of it. They had changed wording in actually in the budget bill that applied to tenure. Tenure is something a faculty achieve after working for several years toward it. It's a process. And they're awarded tenure, and it actually is a Board of Regents decision, but their peers are the ones who review them. The change that was made yesterday was to what's called post-tenure review. So every 5 years after a tenured faculty member achieves tenure, they're supposed to be reviewed. And it's always been done by their peers within their departments. This change makes it apparent that the administration will be more involved in this. They requires that there be an independent substantive review by administrators. Could be a chancellor, provost. And while the system says, you know, that ensures that you don't get a biased review from your peers, faculty are very concerned that it could introduce abuse of power, that some donor or politician who doesn't like a faculty member's research or something they've said could apply pressure to have that person fired.
We're talking to Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel now about the UW Board of Regents meeting yesterday, and we'll pick up that conversation in just a few minutes.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now about the UW Board of Regents meeting in Madison yesterday with Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Karen, we've focused so far on a lot of the spending side of things. Let's get to the revenue side of things. Proposal for increased tuition, but for selected groups of UW system students. Who would be affected?
Well, resident undergraduates have had their tuition frozen for the past 4 academic years, including the current one. So their tuition was not up for consideration. There's already been a move to continue that freeze into next year. But there is no such rule about non-resident undergraduates or some graduate and professional programs. So the largest increases are at UW-Madison. And for non-resident undergrads, each of the next 2 years, the increase will be 6.3%. It's part of a plan that Chancellor Blank had set in motion a couple of academic years ago, in which she wanted to raise tuition for non-resident undergraduates by $10,000 over 4 years. And the idea being that it would generate more money for the university, help subsidize in-state students who don't have a tuition increase, putting more money into scholarships. The professional programs at UW-Madison are having rather sizable increases. The veterinary medicine program, the medical school program, both of those are high-demand programs that attract enough students that they're not worried about raising tuition having an impact on the number of applicants. So one could argue that those who can afford that higher tuition would change, that the applicant pool would perhaps become more affluent.
Now, that UW-Madison out-of-state undergraduate increase, $10,000 you said was the overall target. That sounds like a pretty steep increase. How would that compare to how other schools, comparable schools, treat out-of-state students?
Well, the non-resident increase is almost $10,000 less than the current University of Michigan non-resident tuition and fees. And it's about $2,300 less than Michigan State, according to the chancellor at UW-Madison. She's saying that basically UW-Madison is underselling its programs, that the quality of the education that out-of-state students receive is not reflected in the tuition they pay, and that this additional revenue will help these programs and help the university overall, but it will also boost scholarship funding to make an education more affordable.
This is a case where UW-Madison can rely maybe on out-of-state students and, as you mentioned, professional and certain graduate programs to offset revenue that they're not getting because of that undergraduate in-state tuition freeze. How about other campuses? Are they going to have the same kind of leeway from doing similar things?
Well, the other campuses don't have nearly as many non-resident students, but there were several. There are six total, including Madison, that got permission to raise tuition yesterday. Eau Claire, Green Bay, La Crosse, Milwaukee, Stout, and then also UW Colleges all are raising non-resident tuition next year. But the percentage is much less at UW-Milwaukee. Well, I guess it's 5%, so it's not a lot less, but it is less than the 6.3% at Madison. But like La Crosse, for example, it's a 1% increase. Eau Claire is just a little over 2%, same with Green Bay. So they're much smaller raises, and they have a much smaller pool of non-resident students who will be paying that tuition.
So at those schools, are we hearing concerns that the in-state tuition freeze is limiting? They're not making the money they need to keep up services?
Well, there's another stressor that's coming into play, and that is the demographic shift. UW-Milwaukee especially has been hit by declining enrollments. There are fewer graduating high school seniors. It's just sort of the birth rate blip on the screen that's been going on for the last few years and will continue to pose challenges for universities in the next few years. So, yes, they're saying that they really have been squeezed because tuition is a major source of revenue. And as you know, state funding also has been cut. In the last biennium, it was a total of $250 million over the 2 years. So significant budget cuts have already happened on campus, and they're looking for revenue sources wherever they can find it.
Looking ahead, Karen, budget season is really just kicking into high gear. It's going to be going on for some months. In years past, especially as you mentioned earlier, with the money set aside, the UW funding has been a political football in a way. Do you see it being controversial, a big argument this time around?
Absolutely. And the groundwork is already being laid by chancellors on campuses across the state to really try to beef up and get more support, more vocal support from alumni and businesses to really say, hey, you know, you need to reinvest in education. Because there is a sense it's going to be another very tough biennial budget. There are other competing agencies, and because UW System does have other funding resources, you know, Medicaid is something you have to fund, transportation, they don't have the alternate funding sources. K-12, same thing, is state supported and public fund supported. They don't have tuition or federal funding necessarily that they can turn to make up the slack. So it is going to be a difficult spring, getting ready for the budget to be approved next summer, and I expect that there will be a lot of lobbying going on.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a UW Board of Regents meeting and funding issues for higher education in Wisconsin.
Coming up after the news, our guest shares advice about how to take our cookie baking game to the next level this holiday season.
You can support conversations like this with your pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Dori Greenspan has been known to get up in the middle of the night to try to bake the new cookie she just dreamed about. Cookies have been on her mind for decades, and her son is what she calls her original cookie monster.
Today, she's one of the most celebrated food writers, bloggers, and bakers around. She's won the James Beard Foundation Award 3 times and is the author of 11 cookbooks. If you've got a cookie-making question or a favorite cookie to share for Dori, call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dori Greenspan joins us now to talk about how to celebrate the holiday season with cookies. Her new book is called Dori's Cookies. Dori, welcome to Central Time.
So glad to be here. Thank you. Actually, you know, I not only consider my son the original Cookie Monster, he still puts Cookie Monster on his resume.
And he has done it professionally with you baking cookies. So this is something that you've done your whole life. You bake cookies with your son and also on your own. What is it about cookies that's kept you so enchanted for so long?
Do you know, I think that the possibilities of cookies, what cookies can be, what their shape can be, their flavor, their texture, it's infinite. It's infinite. The only reason I finished Dory's Cookies was because my editor said, it's time. It's your deadline. You've got to turn the manuscript in. I think I could have gone on forever and always just making new cookies. There's something about how you can add new ingredients to a cookie, how you can change the texture, how the look can change. It's just, I find cookies fascinating and delicious.
You share a lot of cookie basics right up front before you get to the particular recipes. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a couple tips? I know you've got ideas about butter and weighing versus volume for measurement. Give us a couple cookie basics that'll clear up some common errors for me anyway.
Well, this seems so basic, but your oven needs to be preheated. And that doesn't mean just turning it on and 10 minutes later putting your cookies in. You really have to give your oven time to come to temperature. And then when that little indicator light or the bing goes off, keep the oven going for about another 10 minutes so that it's really at temperature. Because cookies just bake for a few minutes. So you open the door, heat comes out, put the cookie sheet in, and you don't know what the temperature might be cycling at. So preheat the oven. If you're a lazy baker the way I am, or a lazy cleaner, line your baking sheets with parchment paper or silicone baking mats. You'll never have to wash a baking sheet again, and it helps your cookies bake more evenly. Use cookie scoops. Actually, I give cookie scoops as stocking stuffers every year. I think they're great gifts. And they make, so when you're doing cookies, even simple chocolate chip cookies, if you scoop them, then all your cookies are the same size. Mm. They all bake at the same time. And you don't have, you know, you've been there, kids grabbing cookies. Your cookie's bigger than mine. They're all over, never another fight. They're all the same size.
I live that.
Yeah, me too.
Well, Dora, you had hundreds of cookie recipes saved from your years of baking. So how did you choose which ones to include in this admittedly very big, but how did you choose which ones to put in this new cookbook?
Actually, I didn't. So you're right. I had written and published about 300 cookie recipes when I decided this was the moment for a cookie book. And I decided to just take, about 8 or 10 of my favorites and include them in the book, and then all the other recipes are new. I wanted to stretch. I wanted to see what else I could do. I wanted to discover new things about cookies. And so this is really a new collection.
Yeah, some of them, before we get into the recipes you shared with us, some of them are kind of out there. They have flavors like Parmesan and things like that. They're almost savory cookies as you get toward the end of the book.
They are savory. So there's a chapter in the book called Cocktail Cookies, and they're cookies that are meant to be enjoyed with everything except milk. So they're meant for sparkling wine or for cognac or for red wine. I have a cookie that I love that I created to go with beer. So it's got Old Bay seasoning, which means it's also good with a Bloody Mary, cheddar cheese, and crushed pretzels. It's a great cookie. So I had a lot of fun doing the savories. The Parmesan cheese cookie is a rosemary parm shortbread. Very, very flaky. Great with white wine or champagne. Terrific for the holidays when you're having a cocktail party and you want something that's just beautiful, easy to make. It's a slice and bake cookie. And just unusual.
I want to dig into the recipes now as we talk with Dory Greenspan about her new book, Dory's Cookies. I love the name of this one. This one is called A Chunker. Tell us about what a chunker is.
A chunker is actually, you've chosen our son Joshua's favorite cookie. The chunker is chocolate, chocolate, and chocolate. It's a chocolate cookie that's soft, even when it's cool. It's soft and a little melty in places. It uses over a pound of chocolate. So it has cocoa, it has dark chocolate, it has milk chocolate, it has dried cherries and salted cashews. It's fabulous. The idea for it, the inspiration, was, do you remember the old chunky bars, chunky candy bars?
Yeah, I do. Hmm. Those are good.
Right, raisins and nuts and chocolate. Right, so this is the chunker. Was inspired by that, but I think it's really better than the candy.
Could use some chocolate frosting or something, though, right?
Yeah,
not enough chocolate. No. Yeah.
Not enough chocolate.
Yeah, and by the way, that's one that we have up right now on the Central Time Facebook page and the website, too.
Yep.
Oh, good. Oh, good, good, good. It's a great cookie. Anybody who loves chocolate will love that cookie. And it's a real easy one to make. If you're new to cookie making, this is a good one.
That sounds really good. And the other one you shared, and we, again, have this one up on the Central Time Facebook page, the Cocoa Almond Thumbprint. What's special about this one?
Oh, what's special about it, other than its great taste and its really wonderful texture, is you make it in a flash, literally. It's made in a food processor. Ingredients go in. If you have, you know, an index finger, you can make this cookie, right? Pulse, pulse, pulse. It's done. It's formed into a ball. Stick your thumb in it, bake it, and then fill it with, I like to fill it with chocolate ganache, so a mixture of chocolate and heavy cream. But you could put jam in it. You could put Nutella in it. You could put lemon curd in it. See, this is the thing about cookies. Just you start talking about them, you think, oh, what else can I do with that?
You have a class of cookies in your cookbook that intrigued me because I've never come across them before. You call them jammers. What are those?
That's the cookie I dreamed.
Oh.
So I dreamed the original jammer when I was in Paris. I saw it. It was just baked and beautiful. I woke my husband. He didn't care. I love him, but he's kind of used to this. Like, you know, I'll just like poke him in the ribs and say, oh, I've got this cookie. And he just rolls over. But I got up in the morning and I baked it. And what it is a shortbread, a French shortbread. It's got a dollop of jam in the center and it has crunchy streusel all around it. And I bake it in a muffin tin so that you can actually build the cookie in the tin. And every cookie, because of the tin, comes out exactly the same size with these beautiful smooth edges. And it's a cookie because I call it a cookie, but it's also, it's very much like a jam tart. It's a beautiful cookie. And then once I got what I'm now calling the classic jammer, I thought, oh, I can do other things. I can do a pumpkin jammer with a pumpkin cream cheese middle section and a brown sugar streusel with pumpkin seeds. Or I could do mulled wine.
Ooh.
And cook fruits, cook dried fruits in mulled wine and do a streusel on that. So it's the kind of cookie that you make once and then you, too, will dream about it. You'll dream of variations that you can make your own.
Dory, I'm not a licensed therapist, but how often do you dream of cookies?
Well, doctor, it's, you know, actually, you know, I worked on the book for 3 years. So that's 3 years of thinking and dreaming about cookies 24/7. And so
wow.
I did dream about them. I did, you know, I was at a cocktail bar with a friend. And I was looking at the menu, and there was a cocktail called Bee's Sneeze. And I looked at the ingredients, honey, lemon, ginger, and gin. And I looked at it, and I thought, I can bake that. That's a cookie.
Wow.
And in fact, I turned the Bee's Sneeze cocktail into a Bee's Sneeze cocktail cookie. So when you're so focused on something, you dream about it.
Wow, so you can turn anything into a cookie, it almost sounds like. The Cookinator 3000 or something like that. Well, I want to ask about your last cookie recipe that you shared with us. Of course, there are many more in the book, but you shared with us a Christmas spice cookie. What does that one taste like?
It tastes like Christmas. You know, it has ginger and cinnamon and a tiny little bit of cloves and a tiny little bit of allspice. And I think of those as the scents and tastes of Christmas, and it's a very, very easy dough. It's based on the dough that I call do almost anything dough, because that one dough can be a slice and bake cookie, it can be a thumbprint, it can be a pinwheel, it can be a drop cookie, it can be a rolled and cut cookie. And the Christmas spice cookie is just that. It's the one dough with those spices and then rolled out and cut.
Excellent.
It's a beautiful cookie.
Oh, it sounds just delicious. Dory, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me to join you. This has been fun.
Yeah.
I hope you can now just, you know, leave the studio, go home, bake cookies.
Actually, that is what I'm doing this weekend, as a matter of fact. I don't know. And Rob, but too.
Dory said right now, though. Can we clear that with our bosses?
Yeah, I saw one of them out there.
Okay. Okay. I'm looking at the clock. Yeah, maybe like in a few minutes.
And Dory, just real quickly, before we let you go, is there a recipe in your book that you think kids would really like?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so, there are bunches of kid-friendly cookies. So there are the sablé, which is a very, it's a plain, beautiful shortbread for those who are not crazy adventurous. I love the multi-grain chocolate chip cookie. That's a cookie anybody would love. So it has a little whole wheat flour in it, and it has chopped chocolate. It's a great cookie. There are the chocolate thumbprint cookies there are just too many.
All right, Dory, thank you so much. One more.
Two bite, one chip chocolate chip cookie.
I saw that one. That one looked really easy.
Right. So it's just like a teaspoon of cookie dough with a chocolate chip tucked into it, hidden in it. So it's like a surprise. And kids love that because they bite into it. And there it is, that one surprise chip.
Well, Dory, a lot of great ideas there. Hope we can talk to you again. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Happy holidays. I hope they're sweet.
And to you as well. That's Dory Greenspan. Her latest cookbook is called Dory's Cookies. We can find three recipes that she's shared with us today on the Central Time Facebook page or on the Central Time page at WPR.org.